Professor Murray Smith is my guest this week. Murray is the Professor of Film in the School of Arts at the University of Kent. He's been at Kent since 1992, and we talk about Trading Places. Now, not the film, but in this case, how he came to Kent, because he traded places with another academic from the United States. He talks about how love is part of how he ended up here at Kent, and we talk about whether we'd be the same people now if we'd made different choices at the age of 18. We learn that Murray grew up in Potters Bar and what he did in response to Potters Bar being culturally barren. His parents were born in the 1920s. They had their children relatively late. We talk about the Protestant frugality. We talk about rebellion through conformity. How he has fragmented memories of his earliest years. We talk about the difficulty of distinguishing memories from old photographs. We talk about how the ages of 14 to 16 are quite formative. Music was and still is the most important form of culture, more than film actually, for Murray. His parents were into ballroom dancing and Herb Albert, and I correctly guess what was number one in the charts when Murray was born. Murray remembers watching Virginia Plain from Roxy Music on Top of the Pops and glam rock from the early 70s and the influence of punk. And we talk about novelty music, including the Osmonds. He got into movies as an undergraduate in Liverpool, where he studied English and music, then came back in a big way towards the end of his graduate student days. We talk about Canterbury scene heritages. He talks about the time when he proposed Robert Wyatt for an honorary degree, which turned out to be quite a convoluted process. Murray had an ambition to be a filmmaker. He was active in drama when he was at university. He talks about whether you reach a certain age and think you have only a certain number of cards left to play. We talk about political activism, the relationship between positive and negative memories, how he isn't nostalgic about negative memories, and whether one is satisfied with one's achievements. And we learn at the end of the interview why Murray is both a looking back and a looking forward type of person. And he talks about the fear of doors closing. It was a real privilege for this week's Nostalgia interview to meet Professor Murray Smith from the University of Kent. My name is Chris Deasy. It is such a pleasure to have Murray Smith here from the School of... I always say it's the School of Film, Drama, Visual Arts. Have I got it right?
Well, actually... We can start right there. Yeah. It used to be Drama, Film and Visual Arts. But I regret to inform you, Chris, it's best been the School of Arts for many years now.
But of course, I also wanted to make sure that I got film in the title.
So that's right.
That's my defense.
Well, that's right. It did used to drive me nuts when certain parts of the university, like, you know, you might deal with computing or research services, and they just refer to the School of Drama. Yeah. When it was called Drama, Film, Visual Arts. Yeah. Of course, that raised some hackles.
Yeah. But we had it in religious studies, because anybody listening to this will find this a very sort of niche conversation area. But our module can start with TH, and the TH stands for theology. Ostensibly, at least at one point, it was a theology and religious studies department. So, of course, that would raise all sorts of questions and sort of tussles about actually what these codes represent and which is the senior subject in the field when we offer a religious studies programme.
Right.
So I'm with you on that.
Yeah. So, strictly speaking, it's the Department of Film in the School of Arts.
Yeah,
and soon to be in the Division, Division 1.
Yes, I'd heard that. So, I know. So we've got all these divisions, you know, we're creating divisions, and I'm going to be in the second division. So. But, and you were telling me just before we started recording that you've been here since...
January 92 is when I came, And I actually traded, in a sense, I sort of traded places, believe it or not, with... a rather well-known figure in film studies who was here at the University of Kent and had been part of the founding of the film studies program. So he was here right up to the moment I arrived, pretty much, and went to the university which I left. So just to explain how that happened, his name was Ben Brewster. And Ben was one of the early editors of the journal Screen, which exerted a huge influence on the development of film studies in the 1970s. And he knew people at the place where I did my doctorate, right, which was the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Right. So he, when I went to do my PhD out there in the States, this guy, Ben Brewster, showed up for 1 year and I took two courses with him. So I sort of knew him a little bit from that experience. I knew him quite well in a way. And then when I got to the very end of my doctoral program, lo and behold, the one job, or one of the few jobs that popped up on the horizon, was the one here. And that job had opened up because he was moving back to Wisconsin permanently, having become romantically involved with a young faculty member. So we traded places.
But it's funny how the number of people, including in my own department, who I've interviewed and have said this very publicly, but it's love that brought them to the job they're in.
Sure.
And whatever has happened subsequently, the rationale or the raison d'etre for them to come in the first place was something that was almost very contingent to the academic program.
Right. Well, that sort of also applies to me in a secondary way, or at one remove, because although I came here for the job in the literal sense, right, love the job maybe, my wife is Midi Song. She teaches in SSP, SSR, and she's American, so we met as graduate students in Wisconsin. We came together to the UK. But I started here, and at that point she started a PhD at the LSE. So come 95, around 95, when she finished her PhD, she managed to get a post here. So I don't suppose she would have looked for a post here had I not already been. So love had something to do with that one, or at least convenience did.
It's funny how the decisions that we make, whether it's the first degree that we do and the place we go and the friendships we cultivate, seems almost like predestined or preordained, in the sense that I look back and think, you know, I couldn't have done my first degree anywhere else, or at least I made the right decision. I knew it was the right decision at the time. But then all those friendships, and I'm still in touch with people through Facebook, for example, but they were only made because of that quirky decision at the age of 17.
Sure.
When I may have followed either a teacher's advice or, in my case, I followed my sister, who's also an academic. She's 3 years older than me, and we did the same A-levels and almost the same degree. She did a joint honours degree. And I look back and think, gosh, you know, that one decision at the age of 17 was life-changing, because I wouldn't have made all the decisions that I did in terms of who you meet, who you marry, who you have children with, or whatever it might be.
Sure.
All these decisions are based around this sort of 17-year-old, which is the pace that's most likely to take me.
Well, it's a vertiginous thought that, you know, in one sense, every decision you make is a forking path. True. But some of them really are forking paths.
Yeah. But but I think also the difference with, and the fact you came here, said January 92. I mean, I would have thought, I'm paying you a rich compliment. I mean, you don't have to give away your age, but I just assumed you about my age. But you'd have to be a bit old, because by definition, I was in my first year as an undergraduate back in 92.
I won't give away my age directly, but let's just say the logic of it all fits together. In other words, you know, you came roughly a decade to Kent after I did. Do the maths, and from your age you can calculate
but it's funny though how those decisions are made, and you're right, they're forks in the road. But what we then do after that, you know, it almost feels that yes, maybe if we'd gone somewhere else, or we'd chosen a different course, or, you know, would we have made the same sort of decisions ultimately? Would I still be an academic? But the difference is, with this profession, is that at the age of 18, you decide to study a particular subject. If you stay in this profession, and that may not have been obviously the plan at the age of 18, but in doing that, it's different to sort of like, well, I'll see what this job is like, and in a year's time, I'll do something else. It feels this is more vocational, and I think it's you're in it for the long term, and so getting the decision right at that age, 17, 18, is all the more important. But you couldn't have known that at that time.
That's right.
So you sort of start reading back into it and think, it was meant to be.
That's right. And a dimension of what you've just been talking about is, you know, within the question of having decided to become an academic, a question I do think about now and then is, you know, if I hadn't gone to the graduate school I went to, would I be the same kind of academic? By which I mean, you know, would I have the same approach to my subject matter? you know, if I'd gone to Yale or NYU instead of Wisconsin, well, I've ended up like those terrible people from those graduate schools. And I mean, I think it's undeniable that, you know, you're going to be shaped by any of the environments you move through. But I do also think that in the long run, because you move through environments, you know, so it's not like, you know, I spent 6 years in Wisconsin, for sure being influenced at an impressionable age, you know, by my teachers there. But, you know, I've been out of that school now for 30 years, you know, and over the long haul, I think whatever you pick up at each kind of phase of your life, you know, it's like a sieve. It's like the stuff that really matters, you know, gets through and sort of becomes part of who you are permanently. Mm. And the stuff which, you know, it may take some time that you figure is, you know, less persuasive to you, left less of a mark on you, then it eventually drifts away.
But one thing you just said is very interesting about how we maybe emulate some of the people that we were taught by. It may be teachers, but also it might be actors or radio presenters or comedians. And I think sometimes that, I mean, my parents, I know, used to despair sometimes when I'd be like painstakingly, you know, writing down the top 40 as a teenager on a Sunday. But that, the skill in verticals, the skill in doing that and assimilating information, being very sort of compartmentalized, and also just, you know, ensuring that you're a creature of habits, that there's a consistency in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. These are things I know help me in my academic career, the way that I would assimilate material or write things down, always sort of document everything that I do.
Keeping a diary.
I know we were, so for anyone, I'm sure that will come up again. But doing that sort of information is, you know, something that surprisingly 30 or 40 years later still rears its head. Because I ran a nostalgia night event last week, one of the little tricks was to say, well, I used to write these charts on every week, so somebody give me a date, and I got my little book out, I've got it here, and then counted down the charts as I wrote it out with the brown for the non-mover and the pink for the chart for the numbers going up and purple going down, all the rest of it. And I did it to the Pick of the Pops theme tune, but also I thought, because so doing all of those things all those years ago, it's sort of like, well, it's so a part of me, it needs to go somewhere. And even after all these decades, it never left me. So when I teach, so the long and the short of it is, when I'm teaching, the style of my teaching is no doubt borrowed or influenced by not just academics, but the sort of people who at the time were the go-to people, newsreaders or anything. Just when you think, I like the way they communicate, I like the way they speak, and you're copying them. Mm. So that's what I mean. So it's a broader matrix.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd agree with that for sure.
But going back as far as we can, this is not like an Andrew Neil where I say, well, I'll ask you again. Tell me a little bit about, so obviously you spent 6 years in the States, but where were you born?
Right, so I was born in Barnet, North London, and grew up in Potter's Bar. Barnet is just inside the Greenbelt. Potter's Bar is one of the very first band of commuter towns just north of the Greenbelt. It's often the butt of jokes, you know, in sort of sitcom land. it's the ultimate tedious suburb. Also had a terrible, not when I was a child, I'd long since moved from there, but Potter's Bar was also in the headlines, I guess, in the early 2000s. There was a horrible train accident.
I do remember that, yeah. My dad used to work for the railway, and that came out very
right. It was a high-speed train, which derailed as it came through the station. Yeah. Anyway, born in Barnet, raised in Potter's Bar, which I often refer to as outer suburbia. that was kind of an important part of my experience of growing up, which was that I felt, you know, at least when I reached a certain, I guess sometime in my teenage years, I had a very strong sense of being in a bit of a cultural wasteland. Meaning, you know, because of the sort of force of gravity of central London, you know, 15 miles away. Potter's Bar is 15 miles from the centre of London, but it could have been 200 miles. Everyone with money, essentially, would make their way to the culture available in London proper, which meant that in Potter's Bar, there was just it was just a very barren kind of place culturally. So I spent a lot of time on the 134 bus from Potter's Bar Station into central London, because it was cheap. Obviously, before a certain age at least, the bus was affordable in a way that trains weren't. And the tube doesn't go out to Potter's Bar. It goes to Barnet, Cockfosters, which are just the other... They're just inside the Green Belt. But Potter's Bar is just outside the Green Belt, right? So it's on the... It's on the line out to Cambridge. That's the train line it's on. I sort of grew up in Potter's Bar, but from the time I started to be the person I feel I am.
And see, some people will do that at university. And outer suburb, by the way, I had this image in my mind. I can imagine like a Matt Damon film, outer suburbia. And the Coen brothers, I think, would have to direct it.
I'd be all in favour.
You could play yourself in that. But what about your parents? What did they do? So what sort of background did you have?
Okay, so it was a pretty working class background. By that I mean... But my parents were definitely working class people. They left, they were war children. So my parents were born in 26 and 28. And as you can tell from, or as you could probably calculate from that, they had, unusually for people of their generation, had a family relatively late, in their 30s, basically, right? So, which for people of their class and generation was pretty late. Most of their peers would have been having children, families in their 20s.
Early 20s, about.
So I never sort of like got the story on that other than just, what lay behind their decision to do that, beyond the fact that they were people, they were people of very modest means. And it was part of a kind of Protestant frugality, that they felt they shouldn't have a family until they built up a certain kind of level of protective kind of comfort, not grand comfort, but just a kind of basis, when it would be a little more affordable for them. So my mum's from Bethnal Green, so an authentic Cockney. My dad's from Enfield, so, both North London, East London and North London. And so for them... moving out to Potter's Bar was a kind of definitely a step up the class ladder. So although I say, I mean, I sort of had a lower middle class upbringing in terms of the neighbourhood, but my parents were definitely from a working class background, right? So they left school when they were 13, right? And that partly had to do with the war. I don't know, as a matter of history, what provision there would have been for people of their class in the late 30s, mid to late 30s. I don't know normally what would have happened, but I do know from what they've told me that when the war came, effectively their education was curtailed even shorter than it would have been because of the war.
My grandfather, similar sort of generation. I mean, both my grandparents on my mother's side were born in 1920. But, university was never an option because when he turned 18, he was already in the RAF and the war obviously was imminent.
Sure.
But it's one of his great regrets. And I think that my sister and I were the first in our family to go to university.
Yeah. Sure.
And so for him, it was almost sort of like, well, at least we managed to do what he would have done if he'd had the opportunity.
Myself, my brother, my sister, similarly, we are the first generation university educated people in our family. But I guess it's also true that given that my parents left school when they were 13, it may also be true we were the first to be high school educated, secondary school educated.
One of the findings from doing all these interviews is the number of people in this profession, established like yourself, who were first-generation university. So it's not the case of my father went to university and his father went to university and so on. It was that does happen. Yeah. But in a lot of cases, they've made choices
that, and I guess for myself as well, that my parents, you know, the option is not as though they chose. I mean, my parents didn't choose not to go to university. Yeah, the choice was never there.
Wasn't there. And that was definitely the same for my parents. Mm. So, I mean, that has sort of led to a definite sense in my family of there being a big cultural divide between my parents and the rest of us, which has been, in some ways, quite a fraught divide. My brother, who's 4 years older than me, is also an academic. And I'm not sure I would have had the vision to become an academic had it not been for him. But he did it by, you know, kind of aggressive rebellion, right? Yeah. So he was a ambitious, headstrong, difficult teenager. And I sort of witnessed that and sort of thought, well, maybe I'll do something else. Maybe I'll go a different way. So he kind of like certainly opened my horizons and made me realize that, you know.
But I like that notion of rebelling, and the definition of rebelling is choosing to be educated. Because I watched Blue Story yesterday, the controversial film, which was remarkable in many ways. But it starts with the single mother of one of the impressionable teenage boy who becomes involved in one of the gangs, and she says, you know, I want you to go to a good school. These friends are bad influences. This school has a good Ofsted report, and of course, the peer pressure outwins. But there, being a rebel is really falling into gangs. But in your case, how interesting that it was actually wanting an education and actually attaining all those things that you look back now and think, gosh, how could it be otherwise? It feels almost so conformist, but of course that's easy to say that from the point of view of now, when going to university is so much more the norm.
So to emphasize that even more, I mean, what I think a factor for my brother which gave him momentum and the courage to rebel in that way was that he got into a grammar school. So he attended Hatfield Grammar School. By the time I came to the sixth form, well, I'll just say this so I can get it on the table. You know, I failed the 11 plus. So in that sense, I couldn't have just followed him. But the second thing was that I came of age. I turned 18. Pretty much at the moment that comprehensive schooling was sweeping across, much of England, if not all of it. We live in Kent, which was barely never touched by the comprehensive revolution. But elsewhere, it did happen. And so, just to complete the thought on my brother, it was the fact that he went to a grammar school and started to encounter ambitious teachers, interesting teachers, cool teachers, and fellow students. He was in an environment where being smart, educated, creative, etc., you know, was an interesting thing to be.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And of course, all of that compounded my sense that Potter's Bar was a bit of a desert.
Yeah.
You know, that there weren't that many people or things in Potter's Bar going on of that level of interest.
And particular earliest memories or things you enjoyed doing as a child?
Well, yeah, that I did look over your questions sort of several times to try and get my mind whirring. And that's a particularly interesting one about earliest memories. I mean, I suppose, like a lot of people, I have fragmented memories of my earliest years. But I can't be sure of the, shall we say, the authenticity of the memories. And I'm confident I have reliable memories of things happening in primary school, right? Before primary school, memories of home life and so forth when I was really tiny. Here's the thing. I can bring up images, but every time I bring up an image, I feel like that's from a photograph. You know, that's one of those family photographs from that period. And I can't distinguish, you know, kind of straight memories of my first 5 years from, as it were, having seen pictures of those days, you know. Yeah. But I certainly have memories of primary school. And then The other thing which connects with something I began to say to you a few minutes ago is I suppose I think of my memory sort of segments. I can put it very, very crudely. I mean, there might be a finer grained story I could tell here, but I sort of feel like I became the person I still am in my early teenage years. So by the time I was 16, it's like I still very much identify with the person I sort of, in one sense, I think I was at the age of 16, right? So looking back on the friends I had, the interests I had before the age of about 14, that feels like a foreign country to me.
Yeah.
Like I was a different person then. Mm. You know, obviously, in some sense, an unformed person, but something happened to me between about 14 and 16, which kind of sent me in a certain direction. And of course, you know, a lot of things have developed and changed, and this is just my subjective sense of things, but you know, I certainly have an inner sense of connectedness back to about the age of 16.
Yeah, actually that will lead on to the next question about music, because certainly in my case, growing up with a whole... I mean, you know, there's the influence of your parents sometimes. Yeah. My dad, who was, you know, because he was into Lonnie Donegan and the Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly, so was I. But I never lost that fascination with the music that he grew up with. But at the same time, I had my own sort of genre. But the two were perfectly compatible.
Ah, interesting. Right.
So I went to university and started listening to a lot more Radio 2 than Radio 1 in the early 90s. And I got really excited because I thought it would make me... It would put me into... geographically, I was away from my parents.
Right.
But suddenly I'd be listening to all this stuff. I think, well, this is in his record collection. Right. You know, this is 30 or 40 years old.
Right.
But do you have any sort of similar experiences like that? I mean, did music underscore this transformation? Oh, absolutely. Transformation?
Music was and, in a sense, is still the most important form of culture to me in terms of my identity. So more important than film. Yeah. I'd readily say that.
I would probably say the same thing, because people associate me with film.
Yeah, right.
But then when you get me talking and suddenly it's like, no.
Yeah. So, you know, even now in various ways, I'm very immersed in music, very active in music. Yeah. Just last night I was at this avant-garde music event down in Canterbury. I could tell you more about that if you're interested later on. But coming back to the childhood stuff... Well, with respect to my parents, that would be a good example of the divide, right? They listened to music, but they weren't passionate about music. I mean, one way in which music entered their lives, my parents' lives, was through dancing. They were into ballroom dancing, right? So they were into the kind of music that you would use as backdrop for ballroom dancing, but they weren't really into the music for its own sake. So that's already a difference. You know, and they sort of had a sort of humdrum collection of, you know, odds and ends of middle-of-the-road music, right? Which, in later life, are now treasured items of shared memory for me and my siblings, right? So my dad died almost a year ago, just under a year ago. And one of the things, you know, that we now remember about... You know, growing up with him was he had this record which was the Tijuana Sound of Brass, right?
Herb Albert.
That's right. And, you know, that used to echo around the house endlessly. And they'd inherited, I think, from an older relative, a whole bunch of 78s, but they didn't really play them. So they certainly weren't really, and you know, this is more generally true of them. They weren't... they didn't cultivate culture in the sense we're talking about. So they weren't big readers. They weren't big music listeners. That's part of what we felt we were lacking, right? So it wasn't that they were into something else. Yeah. They just weren't really into that sort of stuff. And to be fair to them, this was partly because of their truncated... education, and the opportunities that came with that. They, you know, my dad had been at a factory since he was 14 or 15. you know. And, you know, my mum with a similar kind of history of immediately being thrust into kind of working responsibilities. So that's what was going on with my parents. Then I've got this older brother. And, of course, you know, to pick up on that story, he was the one who, being 4 years older than me, I mean, it was almost a perfect gap because he was kind of, you know, getting into stuff, you know, and stuff would be coming down to me through what he was listening to. So probably from the age of maybe as early as 10, but certainly 11 or 12, I was getting introduced to stuff through him. And I guess this is the point where I may as well lay on the table my birth date, because then it will help you to gauge what was happening culturally when. So I was born in 62, so I'm 10 years older than you. Is that right?
Yeah, I was born in 73. So yeah.
Okay. December 62. So
what a night! I got that one.
Yeah. So that's right.
I'll pick him on that cue.
And...
because I have to ask you what was number one when you were... I have to ask you...
Frankie Valli, right?
Yeah. Because I have to ask if you know what was number one when you were born.
Now, I'm not sure I do. Mm.
Probably like Frank Ifield or Elvis or something.
I did... When I turned 50, I did do a little kind of personal exercise of researching not just music, but things which happened in 1962. And it was an intriguing...
I'm sorry. Let's find out, ladies and gentlemen at home, I have just reached out, not for the first time in one of the interviews, my Guinness book. Oh, I don't believe that. Okay. Lovesick Blues, followed by Return to Sender. I said Frank Ifield or Elvis.
You did.
No, I couldn't have.
Yeah, that is amazing. Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, can I see?
Please, yeah.
Let's see what else.
So this is. So, yeah, so that would have been the whole era of Bobby's Girl and all the rest of it.
Wait, that's the entire list for 1962?
Of number ones. These were the number ones of 62.
Right, that's amazing, because there's only about 12 records there, or even 10. So these stuck around at number one for...
I know one of them, without looking, was Mike Sarn and Wendy Richard Come Outside, which is as novelty records go.
That's right.
That unfailingly brings a smile to my face.
Well, looking down this list very quickly... aside from Elvis, who appears several times, you've got Ray Charles, you've got Cliff Richard, the young ones, at the beginning of 62, and you've got the Shadows a couple of times. So, yeah, those would have still been resonating a decade later. I mean, a decade later being relevant because I would say that it was from something like the age of 10 onwards that I began to be kind of very tuned into music. So I would have heard stuff in the 60s, but this is part of the story of what I mean about sort of like over a period of maybe 4 years, 4 or 5 years, going from this unshaped amoeba thing that really is just fragments in terms of memory. Do you know what I'm saying? Incoherent fragments. And then gradually that cohering into a sense of who I, in one sense, still am. Right, or the person who has developed from, you know, the thing that emerged in about the mid-70s. Yeah. So music-wise, early memories, I'll come back to my brother in a second, but one vivid memory I have is Top of the Pops from the early 70s. And an extremely influential, glam rock is the trend I remember most. Because I was thinking about your question, I was thinking, okay. So what do I remember for that period? And I thought, yeah, glam rock was definitely the thing that was striking me. So I have strong memories of, I'm going to save the best till last, right? But the lesser bands would have been like Wizard.
That was number one when I was born, by the way.
Slade. Yeah. Of course, Slade were kind of like mega dominant for a couple of years. Mud. Shawadi Wadi, right? A lot of pseudo-50s music going on. But then getting to the better stuff, Bowie, I remember. And the performance which really, to this day, sends a shiver up my spine if I kind of go to YouTube and look it back up. I remember seeing Roxy Music perform Virginia Plain, right? On Top of the Pops, and it's like, wow. So that was pretty influential, shaping on me. What was going on with my brother was he was basically getting into, you know, shall we say, rock as distinct to pop music. So if Top of the Pops was precisely that, you know, it was the singles charts.
Yeah, yeah.
He was basically getting to album music. And so through him, I was introduced essentially to heavy metal and prog rock. So his, I believe his first official album purchase was Deep Purple in Rock, which is, you know, fabulous album. And very quickly he kind of cottoned on to the fact that I was getting into music and didn't lose a moment to start buying me records so that they would be part of our collection. So I think the first record that he bought me was a Led Zeppelin album, Houses of the Holy, with an extremely lurid cover, which no band would get away with nowadays. So even though I was too young, in a sense, to be into that music, you know, this was really the music of people who were born, I'd say, in the 50s.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But because I had this older brother, I was getting steeped in it. And so an interesting thing that happened to me was in 1976, roughly, when punk arrived, I was in this weird sort of double space or double thing.
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, I sort of got it, like, oh yeah, punk. I'm supposed to like this, and I do like it, but wait, where does this leave me with all this stuff I've been listening to for the last 5 years through my, you know, the Pink Floyd, the Deep Purple? And so unlike a lot of people, a lot of my peers, I always had this kind of, well, I was going to say double taste, but you might just say very wide-ranging taste, which went all the way from, you know, the... you know, hardest core progressive stuff to you know, flat out, you know. So the Sex Pistols were resounding from my upstairs bedroom in 1977.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the next record might be, you know,
Under the Moon of Love.
No? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, not that. Yeah. But you know, you know, a Yes album or Genesis.
Because I've got. I can answer the question of, you know, the first record I had bought, I should say, because I was too young at the age of 8 or 9. But the cool answer is Dare from the Human League.
That was a good answer.
But the first single was Bucks Fizz Making Your Mind Up.
Yeah.
But then the real answer, though, to the album was, do you remember those old Top of the Pops albums without the original artist?
The compilations.
The compilation ones without the original artist. And on the front cover.
Oh, I have a few of those. Yeah,
and on the front cover, you'd have those scantily clad women, and it was all, again, you wouldn't get away with those covers today.
Yeah. If you come to my office, I have a few of those on display in my office.
Yeah. but you see, at the time, but I remember in the classroom that primary school, you know, liking Bucks Fizz even then was sort of like a weird thing, even though it was Eurovision and so on. But for me, I've always been on the wrong side of cool in the sense, but actually it doesn't matter anymore, because that whole the Frank Ifield thing, I like the fact that I know all of that sort of music, because I grew up very much with radio, and you know, we can maybe talk about that as well. But radio is something, so it's about the music, but it's also about the context in which the music appears. So for me, I didn't go to gigs in those days, but I would hear short gigs on the radio, but you'd also hear the presenters, you know, infamous one is Mike Reed, and, you know, who decided that he didn't like Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Relax. So he effectively, you know, I mean, we all say it was, you know, it was banned. Well, I don't know. I mean, but it was down to him, because it you know, his tastes were offended. I mean, it's laughable looking back that somebody, you know, and he wasn't the coolest of guys, and yet he was the arbiter almost of taste.
Sure.
So that's what I mean. So for me, that I associate everything with that kind of environment. So what was played, good or bad, Junior Choice, and, you know, Ed Stewart and Tony Blackburn, that kind of is what I grew up with.
Yeah.
And the fascination of that,
yeah.
And the way that it spoke to, in the days before internet and social media, young people who were geographically estranged, but everyone at 8 o'clock on a Saturday or Sunday morning would come together through this program. So it was novelty music, but that's just what it was. Looking back, it might sound absurd, but at the time, that's what the BBC offered.
That's right.
And, and there was a whole demographic and constituency of people, and myself included, for whom this was go-to.
So that kind of music, novelty music, as you put it. Yeah, I should say that, I certainly had a few records before the ones I've been describing, the ones which have sort of stayed with me as part of the taste of the person I became. And so, you know, I have a different relationship. But I do remember, I think my very first album was a Herman's Hermits album, which maybe my parents had bought for me. But you know what I'm saying? You know, so it was sort of, I guess I'd think of it now as, you know, second division pop. You know, 60s pop. I mean, second division relative to the Beatles is what I'm saying. I guess they were very successful, you know, as a chart band. And like, you know, this is getting more into the genuine novelty stuff. Charlie Drake. I had a couple of Charlie Drake.
Not the one with the boomerang. My boomerang won't come back.
Could help me.
Be careful how you answer that one.
I'll have to have a look.
Yeah. Mr. Custer was the other one.
So, you know, sort of pre-adolescent stuff. Oh, and another thing that I remember, I was thinking about when I was looking at your questions, this came to mind. Again, before my tastes were beginning to be properly formed, but I remember the Osmonds were huge, right? This is placing me, right, very precisely. Both the Osmonds and then Jimmy Osmond. With the wretched record Puppy Love. So there was all of that stuff swirling around. But eventually, probably quite quickly, the other stuff I was describing, first of all, heavy rock, progressive rock, and then when the punk revolution came, all of that swept all of the pre-pubescent stuff.
And do you find now that same music still, that particular music has, not the Jimmy Osmond, obviously, has a hold over you? Do you listen to new music? Or was there a point at a certain age, because you mentioned how important the age 14 was in terms of coming into your own, but was there a point where you reached, for want of a better term, saturation point, and you just thought like I did. And for me, and I joke about this, and I did it in the Nostalgia Night, for me it was New Kids on the Block. Then it was like, this is not me anymore. I wrote the charts down every week, and suddenly I just thought, I'm not interested in this anymore.
I think less so than other people. I mean, in one sense that's true. So I think when I listen to music of, you know, the 70s and up to the early 80s, it has a certain kind of emotional hold on me. That even music I've come to love and admire released after that, you know, very little released after the mid-80s has the same kind of impact on me, just from this point of view. It's about when I encountered it in my life, right? I think compared with a lot of people, I did carry on exposing myself to new music. Well, I mean, selectively. But you know, I'm not one of these people who... you know, really just kind of stayed fixed on the music of my youth and never carried on listening to new stuff. So even now, I listen to new stuff. And I'm always glad to be exposed to something which sort of holds my attention in the same way the historical stuff does. I suppose another thing that I find nowadays is that with the advent of, you know, various things, certain technologies like the internet, things like YouTube, and what we academically talk about as the archive, capital A. You know, this one can spend endless hours of time going back to the music you loved at the time, but wandering down these byways, right, that you didn't know about at the time.
Yeah.
Right, because you know now you can get all of these other releases which were obscure or not available. You can listen to bands which were very similar but which didn't have the same level of success, and now this stuff is available. So I would say it's only kind of in the last few years that I have noticed right, that it's like I'm just totally disconnected and uninterested in contemporary pop culture, in the sense that I'll see the names of the latest generation of stars and I'll just think, I have no idea what these people do. Like, I see that, you know, like what kind of noise do these people make?
Well, somebody, I was at somebody's house a couple of years ago, and they were, it might have been the Brit Awards that they were watching.
Yeah.
And I suddenly felt this weird nostalgia for the 1989 Brit Awards. You remember the infamous Sam Fox and Mick Fleetwood, which was terrible.
Right.
But at the same time, it was sort of like, well, for my generation, that, and actually, I think the Who actually appeal, or one of those, but that wasn't an intentional pun. But that sort of era, it kind of felt that it spoke to us, and the, I think Noel Edmonds was presenting one of those the year before, and it just somehow felt particularly of its time.
Yeah.
In a way that now I'm still as interested as I ever was in the charts from those years, but I cannot sustain the interest in, like, when my own children were born, no interest.
Yeah.
I can you know, I knew what was number one when you were born without even knowing when you were born. but I could not tell you, even though I've looked it up, I do not know. I couldn't even remember, couldn't retain the information of who who was in the charts when my children were born.
Yeah.
So it's, so it's interesting.
Yeah. How old are your children?
They're very young. They're the eldest is seven, and the young, and I got, so seven, six, and twins are four. So really, no.
Four children.
Yeah, two of them are twins, though. So, but it's still four children.
Yeah.
But in the same way, with or in a different with music with film, it's the opposite. I go to see all the new releases, so I've kept up to date with film. It's almost as though when the music, I didn't used to go to the cinema ever when I was a child, but I knew all the soundtracks. I knew Ray Parker Jr. and I knew all the Axel F stuff, and you know, Beverly Hills Cop, and I knew Ghostbusters and so on, but and I knew they were related to films, but I didn't know the films until much later. But it's almost as though there was a point when I stopped being interested in the music, and the film took over.
Yeah,
that's curious. It's almost as though I just found a different outlet, and I came of a certain age, and just thought one was a more profitable way of going forward than the other.
Right. Well, there's a little bit of a parallel there with me, which I guess won't surprise you, since I became a a film academic. So I hadn't been, because, and I'm thinking that another one of your questions is about film.
Yeah.
I really wasn't like a movie kid, right? You know what I'm saying? I wasn't one of those kids who got into like movie culture in their teenage years, their young teenage years, or even younger. And I know, I've known people like that, you know, who were obsessive about films from a really young age. For me, you know, it was a very definite period. In my very late teens, really kind of while I was an undergraduate student, that's when I got into movies.
Yeah.
I was a student at the University of Liverpool, and there was a regional art cinema in Liverpool called the Blue Coat Chambers. And, you know, I got a membership, and I started going religiously, and I go and watch Bergman and Godard and not understand most of it. Yeah, it's a typical thing, right? So, like, well, you know, aren't I very cool watching all these movies and not really understanding most of them? So I got into film in this kind of intense burst as an undergraduate student. And when that happened, for a while, I almost hung my musical boots up. You know, I play guitar, but I sort of stopped playing guitar. I stopped buying albums. You know, my interest just really kind of got sucked up by film. Then I went off to graduate school in America, and going to America was all part of the obsession, right? You know, because I'd figured out that, you know, film meant or had a kind of cultural standing in the US that it doesn't really have in the UK. But then I found music kind of coming back in a big way. When was it? Towards the end of my graduate student days, maybe in about year four of six, I just suddenly found that I started to buy albums again, started to go to live shows again. So there was a sort of brief hiatus in the intensity of my musical passions, but it didn't last for long, really, in the scheme of things. So then it came back very strongly.
But we'll come back to film in a moment. Yeah. But I mean, related to that is, how did you end up as an academic? Because I'm assuming that you did you do film studies for your degree?
Undergraduate degree was English Lit.
Oh.
well, actually, English language and literature. I mentioned the language bit because it's amusing to record that apparently I was one of the top achieving students in the first year in Old English, Anglo-Saxon. And they tried to persuade me to kind of like...
Well, you got that one over me, Murray. That's, you know,
yeah. Well, they were already admitted that I failed the 11 plus, so I'm going to work in these counterbalancing achievements where I can. The truth is, you know, as you can probably guess, not a great many students are hot on their Anglo-Saxon. Their interests tend to go elsewhere, so it wasn't that big a deal that I'd sort of got one of the best marks in the year for the Anglo-Saxon. All it meant was I was a dutiful student, so they tried to kind of persuade me to kind of specialise in that area, but I resisted. So while I was an undergraduate doing the English language and literature degree, I was able to do one advanced option in film, taught by a guy called John O. Thompson. And that set me going. That was all part and parcel of my getting interested and passionate about film. And then when I went to the US, I did an MA and a PhD there, and that was all film studies.
Many academic in my own department, even, you know, did first degrees in actually English has come up quite a few times, and then history, and then they end up becoming biblical studies or even the sociologists of religion. So completely different fields, really, but maybe at PhD level they were looking at, for example, the Bible as literature, and then become a biblical studies person by default, but just because that was their main focus. It's very common.
I suppose just to sort of, one thing I can just add is that English literature was my undergraduate, MA and PhD were in film, and then of course that sort of set me up to have a career in film. But as my career has worn on, I've gradually stopped being a conventional film studies person. I don't really do research in the mainstream of film studies anymore. As you might know from bits and bobs you'll have picked up, I've really become an aesthetician, right? So I do work in philosophical aesthetics. So I have a lot to do with your other colleagues in SECL.
Like Simon Kirchin.
Exactly. And that's partly a reflection of the fact that, you know, we've talked already in the last half an hour a lot about music. Yeah. I did an undergraduate in English literature. Really, my instincts run very broadly across the arts. Not across all of them, you know, but a number of different art forms. And I've sort of felt as my career's gone on that I've needed that space. So although I did have this sort of period in my 20s when I became very obsessed with film, so right through my 20s, you know, in graduate school but beyond it, you know, I would just be one of these people like absorbing films like a sponge, watching them. But eventually that sort of habit diminished a bit. So now, as I say, this is why right at the beginning of our conversation, this is one reason why I said to you, you know, music is probably as important or more important to me in terms of my inner identity as film is, you know.
Yeah, and I find in with the nostalgia work as well that music is clearly the linchpin.
Right, that's interesting.
For people who will not define themselves so much by their academic pursuits.
Yeah.
Very few of them, if any of them, will, you know, study music as part of their degree. Yeah. I mean, I did GCSE music and I also learned the piano and I was used as a both. My worst GCSE mark was in England, was in music, and yet music was my passion. Yeah. But of course, it wasn't the scholarly study of music. It really was listening to the charts on a Sunday and all the rest of it, you know, which, you know, is a completely different thing. Yeah. In the same way that I teach religious studies, but of course, there are some students who are dutifully religious people, that's not the same thing as wanting to study it. So I think we all need those sort of demarcations, and some things need to be kind of outside the orbit of not so much academic stuff. I don't think, because I mean, the stuff on nostalgia is clearly my academic work, but sometimes there are passions which precede those and will define us irrespective of what we do or don't do in any scholarly academic setting.
That's right.
And they will carry with us whether we are or are not in this profession.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. One other thing that maybe I'll just slip in, because it's sort of been on the edge of my mind as we've been talking about various other things. In terms of formative musical tastes and influences and the degree to which that sort of stuck with me or not, well, one wing of progressive rock music was, of course, the Canterbury scene. I don't know how familiar you are with this, but the Canterbury scene. So in the late 60s, at the Simon Langton School, the local Simon Langton School, there grew up from that seed a wing of the progressive rock scene, which became, you know, internationally famous, and in a sense has proven to have legs in a way that no other branch of that musical phase has. So the bands I'm talking about are Soft Machine, Caravan, and Gong. They were the big trio of bands. And then there were many other associated acts who were, who are either less commercially successful or less famous. But it's just a coincidence that I ended up getting a job in Canterbury. But in the last decade, I've taken a great interest in, a convenient, if in some ways unhappy way of describing it, would be Canterbury scene heritage activities. In other words, I've become very interested in the vestiges of those bands, because some of the musicians are still around and are still active. And there's enough awareness in and around the town that there used to be this really great music scene here, that you've got younger bands who now look back to that and kind of build on it, right? So...
Well, we were talking earlier about this notion of meant to be.
Yeah.
And I was looking at when you go to university. So in your case, it seems as though, even though you went to Liverpool, you went to the States.
Yeah.
It sounds as though you were going to end up here eventually.
Maybe that's the case. Yeah. Maybe that's the case. Yeah. So, among the more substantial actions on my part in relation to this is... In 2014, Robert Wyatt, who was originally the drummer in Soft Machine, then he had a bad accident in the early 70s and paralyzed himself. And from that point onwards, he became like a singer-songwriter. Probably his best known, he sang a version of the song Shipbuilding. It's an Elvis Costello song originally, right. So anyway, that's Robert Wyatt. So I proposed him for an honorary degree. And the second time around, I had to propose it twice. Second time around, I think the first time around, nobody on the committee knew who the hell this Robert Wyatt was. So
you overthrew the committee and then...
Well, no, what happened was that the first time around, I'd had no experience of proposing anyone. And I just... Nobody had explained to me how it worked. And I think the only contact I'd had would be when sort of the dean or somebody very high up in the food chain would sort of say, can you give me suggestions for, honorary recipients of honorary awards? And all you'd have to do is offer, like, the name... And maybe a sentence to kind of say, the well-known musician from the 80s or whatever, right? I also proposed, at that level of proposal, I also proposed Susie of Susie and the Banshees.
Yes.
That didn't get taken up. But then I didn't press that one. So that one could still be made. But I found out when I asked around that, of course, the real process is it goes to committee, and when it goes to committee, a case has to, there's a form. right? Yeah. So, and I hadn't realised that, and so I don't really know what happened the first time around. For all I know, the proposal may never have reached that point,
yeah.
right? But the second time around, I took control of it and actually filled in the form and made a proper case. And it got through,
yeah.
and that was great because over and above the fact that Robert Wyatt is an extremely interesting individual, great musician, interesting musician, he also kind of sort of represented the scene. Do you know what I'm saying? It was also about getting recognition for that school of musicians, you know, who certainly kind of like are as significant to the cultural output of this area as anything that goes on at the university, and I thought they deserve recognition, so I was very very pleased to get
and you introduced him.
Well, interesting question. I didn't introduce him. I mean, at the end of the day, I was happy enough with the way things played out. I got to meet him and so forth, but I was surprised and not a little peeved at the way the system works, because essentially, although I proposed him and the proposal was successful, it was as if from that point onwards it was an entirely impersonal thing, and it was given over to the, you know, whatever, that the communications office, and I would have had no more involvement in it. I wouldn't have been recognised as having made the proposal had it not been for the fact that, you know, one or two people kind of knew that I had been behind this and made an individual point.
And had you been in touch with Robert Wyatt himself in any capacity? So did he know that you...
No, not until the day of the ceremony, because on the day of the ceremony at the cathedral, I basically just went and found him out. Introduced myself, and maybe I won't name the names here, but I mean, one of the university orators, is that what they call
them? Yes, they are, yeah.
Right, had been invited to, so to speak, do the job, meaning go visit Robert Wyatt, sit down, talk to him so that they could formulate a talk about Robert Wyatt. And it did strike me that this was all a bit odd. When, you know, when somebody else had taken the trouble to propose him. So
yeah, no, I can imagine if I recommended a particular hero of mine.
Yeah, like Frank Ifield.
Frank Ifield, who lives in Australia these days. If he came all the way from there to do, you know, and I proposed him, and then I felt that somebody else was reading this out thinking, you know, this is my childhood. I would feel very conflicted.
Yeah, well, I mean, at a certain level... I was and still am bothered by it. The person who gave, you know, the orator who was chosen was somebody who I thought demonstrated a genuine interest and some feel for what Robert Wyatt had achieved and who he was.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel that, you know, there was an issue about Robert Wyatt being somehow kind of not properly respected.
Yeah.
Or honoured by what the system had thrown up, but yeah, I thought it was a typical kind of, you know, cack-handed thing on the part of the university that their procedures wouldn't just have, you know, a standard part of the procedure where you would kind of recognise where a proposal has come from.
And I also find that whole notion of meeting your heroes, shall we say, problematic when the context in which you meet them is a kind of an impersonal space that somebody else has organised. I met Thelma Schoonmaker, who's very much associated with Canterbury. And I had done my PhD, which was significantly on Scorsese. Her name comes up in a lot of my work. Such a pleasure to meet her. And I had a chance to ask her a question. And I found that meeting her was a very strangely alienating experience, because I think I put her off a bit with the whole sort of, oh, I did my, you know, rather than think, oh, he's done a PhD on this, let's have that conversation. I think that there was a bit of a mismatch there.
Yeah, sure.
And I think she probably felt a bit like, oh my God, he's going to ask me all these terribly academic questions.
Right,
the sort of questions that other people were asking at that event were, do you think there's too much violence in these films?
What's
his name again? You know, and it was sort of like, so in other words, they knew nothing about Scorsese.
Was this down at Christchurch?
This was at Christchurch.
Yeah.
Maybe you were there, yeah.
You know, I have a bad feeling I couldn't attend it for some reason, but I vividly remember it happening, right? Because
2007, end of the year.
Yeah, because she was she married to Michael Powell?
She was married, and of course she met through Scorsese, because he was Scorsese was heavily influenced by Powell and Pressburger, and so she met him via Scorsese.
I guess you came here after Ian Christie had gone, right?
That's right.
Yeah, but he sort of knew.
He did all those like Scorsese on Scorsese.
Yeah. So he knew Thelma and may have had a hand in facilitating the whole Christchurch thing. But they really stole a march on us. We got Derek Jarman.
Yeah.
Well, which is fine actually. Yeah. Which is fine. But,
but just thinking of other things. At university, and I'm going to ask you this question. Mm. I'm just conscious of time as well, more than anything else, because politics, religion, sports. But no, this is good. This is good. And and I actually don't edit, but unless I absolutely have to. But to do with voting, politics, religion, sports, radio. You know, things that you know. I at university. Mm. Particularly, is there anything from that sort of era that makes you think, yes, that was that defined
from,
that era?
Right, from the university period.
Yeah, I mean, you can extend it if you like, but I mean, that I sort of ask as a sort of cauldron of growing up and sort of the influences at that formative age.
Right. Well, let's see. Yeah, I guess my undergraduate years, I've said one or two things, which was that was the period when I became obsessive about film. Mm. And that went hand, actually, and the thing I can add to that is that it was initially, I wanted to understand films, so I was watching, you know, I was consuming films like a madman, but it was also with a view to becoming a filmmaker. Yeah. So, in, you know, as is not at all uncommon, right, I was one of those, you know, late teenagers, early 20s people who basically, you know, had ambitions to become an artist, in my case. Well, you know, I was heavily involved in the university years in terms of drama. So I was acting on stage. I'd also acted in secondary school, and I sort of graduated to directing. So I directed plays, stage plays, as an undergraduate, and then started to do some primitive film projects, just like Super 8 film projects. Now, you know, the concise version of that story is over the kind of 5 or 6 years from that undergraduate moment through to the end of graduate school, I sort of learnt, okay, my aptitude doesn't really lie with filmmaking, right? I'm a much better talker and thinker, sad to say, about film than I am a maker of film. But I don't make any grand claims about it, but certainly I was very active in drama just prior to the kind of filmmaking stuff. And I sort of feel that filmmaking ended up being a somewhat unfinished chapter for me, that this is going to sound terribly pretentious, but another way of putting it was I sort of became... it's going to sound terrible. I sort of became an intellectual.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's where I sort of felt my center of gravity was settling, right? What I mean is an intellectual rather than, you know, a thinker about the arts rather than a maker of the arts. But I sort of feel that my ambitions to try filmmaking were somewhat truncated by a variety of things, some of which were purely practical. Mm. You know, that you know, compared with the stage, where you can do things relatively cheaply and easily, filmmaking, especially back then, before video, certainly long before digital, everything was much more expensive and difficult.
Yeah.
Right? So it was hard to get experience as a filmmaker unless you had to be incredibly determined to make short films.
Yeah.
And for me, I sort of found that I had this other aptitude for you know, for academic work in general, for film, the study of film in particular, and I was getting a lot of encouragement from the people who were teaching me film in graduate school. I only went to America thinking I'd do an MA in a year, and I stayed for 6 years. Yeah. And that was because I was so excited by the graduate film program, intellectually excited by what I found there. Yeah. It kind of made me realize that, you know, the academic domain could be exciting in a way I hadn't realized before.
Do you think you would ever go back to those impulses? Or do you obviously you're very much settled in this profession, but do you still have that drive to maybe just try out that sort of thing?
They still are there. Yes, we've come on to another one of your questions. The making impulses have never completely gone away, but they've been diverted into music. Actually, what I've never completely let go of is a certain engagement with music making. I mean, it's very much been on the back burner for the most part, you know. Partly because, you know, the last 20 years for me has been dominated by family life, right? Yeah. My kids are older than yours. Yeah. My kids are 21 and 18.
Gosh, yeah.
But as I've been gradually exiting the pressures of family life, so musical involvement, and now I'm talking about playing, has sort of come back for me a bit.
Yeah.
So filmmaking, sure, it's still there. And I can even imagine kind of getting involved in film projects collaboratively with other people. But I suppose, you know, another thing that happens to you once you get to serious middle age, as I have, right, is you do reach a point where you begin to think, you know what, I do only have so many more cards to play.
Yeah.
Right? And so I have to decide about, you know, where I'm going to put my time and energy now, because it's not going to go on forever.
No, and I found that the things that I really wanted to do, if you'd asked me, in fact, I would have given you exactly the same answer, 6 or 16, what do you want to do? I said, I want to do something on the radio. And yet it's an unfulfilled ambition. But of course, even doing this podcast, I'm very aware that I'm kind of doing what I always wanted to do. And although I've loved the academic profession, it was more sort of accidental, I suppose, that I hardly fell into it. I did a degree and I stayed, and you know, so it was very much a case of doing all the work, but kind of feel that there's unfinished business, and it goes back to so in a way my life's probably better and more rounded for having done what I've done. And if I do ever find myself doing something radio based, at least I can say, well, you know, in between, should we say, I've had the most amazingly productive, challenging, erudite sort of lifestyle. But at the same time, it's interesting what you're saying there, you know, that whole notion of dreams. Well, and we'll come to that formally in just a second, but that sort of notion of chasing those dreams, and those dreams tend to stay often for life.
So I think I'll always have that those ambitions. They'll never go away, the ambitions to be a maker rather than a studier. And realistically, I suspect that those ambitions will always feel somewhat unrealized or underrealized, you know, even if I become a bit more active as an amateur musician, which is gradually happening. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's clearly going to be, you know, a relatively low-key kind of thing. It can't be otherwise when you start to... Yeah. Involve yourself in this kind of stuff when you're already in your 50s.
I guess the thought of, I could say it now at the O2, it's Jeff Lynne and Murray Smith.
You know, but, you know, I will say, you know, that just very quickly sweeping back through the Canterbury scene, music scene connections. I mean, not that I'm playing with these guys, but through a combination of becoming a bit more active as a musician, but also somebody who's on the scene as a kind of a historian and a critic and an appreciator of the music of the of this period and this tradition. You know, I am going to be, you know, I'm going to be going to the studio of one of the Canterbury scene musicians to interview him.
Yeah.
I'm going to be switching seats and talk to him about, you know, about his involvement in the band Caravan. Yeah. And, you know, I have some very specific questions because I'm writing a long essay. Yeah.
And actually, I've heard seen your interview with Lars von Trier. It was the comment.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah. I did the an interview with him for Antichrist.
The Antichrist. I knew William Dafoe was in it. How apt. The Last Temptation of Christ, Antichrist. That's William Dafoe.
So one other thing I would say in response to your question about, you know, what were the dominant passions of the undergraduate years. I mean, in addition to the things I've already told you about, one thing I could say about politics is it's certainly true that, you know, as is not uncommon, you know, especially for people of my generation, your generation, those years were important in terms of consolidating where I was politically. I, you know, which is to say, like most people in our profession, you know, on the left. That certainly was very much part of my life in Liverpool in the early 80s when I was at university. And that was a period, like, I went to Liverpool University autumn 81, and that summer there had been riots in Toxteth.
Yes.
Right? Which, you know, so it was early in the Thatcher era, you know, it was another age of strong political polarization. So, yeah, that shaped my my views strongly. But one thing which I would say, and maybe the strike makes me reflect on this. I mean, you know, how am I going to put this carefully? I've never been a huge fan of, you know, political activism as a thing you do.
Yeah.
You know, it for me, it's a necessary evil. You know, that we have to spend time protesting, demonstrating for the things that we think are important. I don't regard this as particularly a thing to get proactively excited about, unlike a lot of people who I think actively embrace the kind of community side of political action, you know. I'm of the left in terms of my political views.
No,
I think I'm a slight oddball, or not, maybe, I don't know. Maybe people don't admit to this, especially when, as it were, they're on the left. But, you know, I'm not a great one for those kind of collective.
I would say that I'm the same, but I'm very clearly of the left, and I'm more excited about politics actually with Jeremy Corbyn as leader, because at least he has very clear convictions and commitments, which I couldn't always say about some of his predecessors.
Yeah,
and yet I wouldn't go on strike in the way that would, you know, seems to be a kind of not inevitability, but certainly Corbyn is very supportive of industries that have gone on strike.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that personally, but also it's like the abortion debate. You don't have to, you know, the freedom to choose, or being pro-choice, means you can choose, an abortion or not have an abortion. It doesn't mean to say you always choose in one particular way. Right. So I think you can support a cause, but it doesn't mean to say you have to be an activist in that. You can support it in theory, you can support it in practice, but that's not the same as going on a picket line, for example.
Right.
That's not for everyone.
Yeah, and maybe to be even more specific about this, there are certain, you know, aspects of committed political life that sometimes surface. You know, I'm thinking of a certain, you know, there can be a certain kind of heavy-handed authoritarianism within political, you know, a pressure to conform. Maybe authoritarianism is too strong a word, but a pressure to conform, to toe the party line, which I'm resistant to. And there's a certain kind of self-righteousness which goes along with not just the left, but any kind of concerted political community, you know. So I know where I am politically, and certainly those views, you know, came out of my class background and my early university years. But there's a dimension of political community life which is a bit anathema to me.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. So. Well, I've got a few more. And appropriately, in terms of what you were saying about your wider interest in philosophical aesthetics, but a few more philosophically based questions to round up. Would you say, Murray, that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey the whole of your life?
Yeah, I think so. Though I guess I have a kind of on this score, I've got a view about kind of how, you know, the human mind works in this respect, which is to say, I think that, a normally functioning human mind is pretty good at not exactly repressing, because I wouldn't want to give succor to Freudian views of the human mind, but not repressing bad memories. But I think that, too much dwelling on bad memories can become, you know, dysfunctional, right? Mm-hmm. And people who are preoccupied much of the time with truly bad, troubling memories will tend not to be well functioning people.
Yeah.
So I would say that what I'm saying is I think I'm a reasonably well adjusted person, and I think what that amounts to is not that you don't have some bad memories, but that you will, you know, most of the time, you know, you will, your mind will be preoccupied and dominated by better rather than worse memories.
Well, no, because, I mean, concomitant with that is the question about whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences.
Right.
And I don't know if that is related to that answer.
Yeah, I think it is. And I thought that was a very interesting question. Mm. I would say this. I don't think it's, you know, because I was thinking of bad, what are my worst memories, right? And like anyone, you know, for sure, I've got a little, you know, inner drawer of really bad, uncomfortable memories. You know, memories of things that I did that I'm not proud of things that happened to me that were profoundly painful and I haven't been able to transform them in my mind. I haven't been able to kind of say, well, some good came out of those, you know. Mm. So I've got a little collection of really bad memories. And when I bring them to mind, and what does connect with the answer I just gave you a moment ago is that I think I will normally only bring those memories to mind when there's a very special context which compels me to.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I don't think I feel anything like nostalgia for them because they are just too difficult, right? And in no sense would I want to go back to them, would I want to relive them. Mm. I'm not tempted to say it was all for the best, you know, for these particular memories, right? What I would say, just to add a further thought to your question, is I think that it is possible for nostalgia to do its work by transforming what was a very difficult experience into an experience which you've come to think of in a more complex way, which had at least, so to speak, a good dimension to it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So my answer to your question is, twofold. I'm saying I think that I still have bad memories, which I cannot think of being in the frame of nostalgia because they're too purely bad memories. But I can think of experiences I've had in the past, which I can be nostalgic about, which have some dimension of difficulty attached to them or pain attached to them.
But I guess it's like a movie where if you watch nothing but a Disney-fied version of everything, you would probably feel that there needs to be more to this. You need something that goes a bit deeper, more challenging.
Right, sure.
I mean, you know, for every like comedy, you know, you need a Scorsese or a Tarantino sometimes just to sort of jerk you into shape. And I think that in the same way, sometimes a bad experience, if and only if it has led to something positive, if you got out of that and you had the resources to do it, then what you can be, and maybe nostalgic is not the right word, but there's a sense in which you thought, well, against the odds and without any prior almost like form for doing this, you manage to change your situation. You can look back and say, gosh, and that's the paradigm. It's the, so you're not nostalgic about the bad situation, but about overcoming that adversity and showing that you've got that ability against the odds sometimes to surmount the insurmountable. And I think that's where sometimes it's possible to look back and think, gosh, how did I manage that? How did, and that's what, you know, you see that in films, you see it in fiction, you see it in, you know, in interviews when, you know, somebody will talk about, I mean, if everybody had a life where nothing bad happened to them, then in a way they're very dull people. So you sort of need those peaks and troughs, but rising out from those troughs can be, is the source for, I mean, I keep a diary. I mean, the diary isn't, you know, often is a letter to oneself, almost sort of, why did I not stand up, or why was I so feeble in that situation? And if you manage to change the odds, you can think, God, this is actually, the first-hand account of that is amazing. Right.
Okay, so I can certainly agree with you on that dynamic. You know, another way of putting that would be that I can certainly look back and so to speak, take a certain amount of pride in having overcome certain bad experiences in the past, so that's certainly true.
And I've just got a couple of questions to ask. That whole negotiation that we have with our younger selves. You know, I mean, we were talking earlier about having dreams from childhood, and whether you're still chasing those dreams today. But do you feel that you fulfilled the dreams that you had from when you were young? What sort of conversation would you have with your younger self about what you've managed to achieve?
Well, I guess I can summarize this fairly neatly by saying two things. I mean, on the one hand, I feel like I just haven't achieved the dreams that I had, right, as a teenager, because those dreams definitely at a certain age focused on being, you know, being a maker rather than a studier, right? And that's not primarily what I've become. On the other hand, I do think that there is something to the thought that, you know, whenever you kind of accomplish one target you've set for yourself, you know, by definition, that target suddenly is no longer visible. And a new one is visible. And you know, you're now feeling a sense of, you know, desire and the dissatisfaction, which is part of desire to accomplish that next thing, right? So I suppose I am just about wise enough, or feel I've gained enough wisdom to recognize that, although I definitely have that sense that I haven't entirely, for sure, realized the dreams that I had for myself when I was younger. On the other hand, I think that it's part of a certain kind of human psychology, maybe not everyone's, but a certain type, that whatever you achieve, right, you know, for a certain kind of mindset, well, you know, now you've achieved it, that's not satisfying you, right?
Yeah.
Of course, this is connected with the Buddhist analysis of desire, right? You'll never satisfy it.
But at the same time, neither are you therefore complacent, or at least if there is complacency, then that's a sign that you need to move on. So that can actually be a very positive moving impetus. Otherwise, you just get stuck in the same sort of rut. And my very last question, Murray, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Yes, I saw that question on your list. And that's, in a way, quite a tricky one me to answer. I mean, I'm tempted to say, you know, both. I certainly recognize the force of nostalgia. That was one thing that attracted me to your project when you got, you got in touch with me about it. You know, that I do think a lot about past episodes in my life, and for the most part reflect on them at least with a certain, with a degree of positivity. On the other hand, I wouldn't say I'm. Oh, I'm trying to think of the name of a Jethro Tull album now with a relevant title here. You know, Living in the Past. That's the album. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't say I entirely live in the past, right? Yeah. In the sense that, you know, maybe some people do to great an extent. I do, you know, I do look to the future. One of the more challenging things, I think, about getting, as I've put it earlier in this interview, becoming a seriously middle-aged person, as opposed to a just middle-aged person, is that, you know, forward thinking gets more complicated, right? Because you just do begin, as I said to you a little while ago, you just begin to realize, well, you know, how many more decades, how many more cards am I going to have to play, you know? And you start to feel, I've got to choose what I, how I use my time bit more carefully now.
I thought Hillary Clinton summed it up, but she was paraphrasing her husband about how he apparently had said to her that at their age now, you know, they're both in their 70s, they have more yesterdays behind them than they have tomorrow's ahead of them. And in a way, it's sort of very obvious, but in terms of if you're in your 70s and you want to run to be president, in a way, you have there's a certain urgency, should we say.
That's right. The Germans have a great word, right? Germany has so many great words of this type, you know, the compound words. So the word I'm thinking of is, and I'm going to mispronounce it, but it'll have to be good enough, Torschlusspanik. Which means, you know, I think it literally translates as fear of diminishing opportunities. Mm. And more idiomatically, it's like fear of doors closing. You know, that the older you get, right, the fewer opportunities there will be further down the road.
Yeah.
And in many senses, not just because you have less time, but because your physical and mental capacities will gradually start to, you know, dry up on you, right? So, you know, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'd say I'm a moderately optimistic person and a moderately forward-thinking person, although, as I've tried to suggest for me, it's not an either-or. Yeah. I think I do spend a good amount of time reflecting on the past, but not to the exclusion of thinking actively and positively about the future. But I do feel a change, right, in the way that works as one gets seriously into middle age. It's hard not not to affect.
Well, on that quite literally bittersweet note, because I think we've covered all the ranges there. Murray, it's been fantastic to catch up with you this afternoon.
Likewise, Chris. Thank you. Thank you so much for asking me to do this. It's been a real pleasure.